Welcome to episode number 9 of Tech Talk Today on WCCR 94.5 LPFM, live from the beautiful campus of University of the Cumberlands in Williamsburg, Kentucky. Triple T provides you with the latest news in the tech world and our opinions of what it all means. I'm Justin Hensley.
And I'm Kurt Lawson. Let's get Triple T started with this week's Tech Roundup. And the, let's see here. In cryptocurrency news, we haven't had too many of these. U.S. states edge toward crypto coin regulation. I was on Slashdot. A user points out that an article from the Pew Charitable Trust Research and Analysis Department on the legislation and regulation schemes emerging in at least a few states in reaction to the increasing use of digital currencies like Bitcoin. A working group called the Conference of State Bank Supervisors Emerging Patents Task Force, wow, that is a name, have been surveying the current landscape of state rules and approaches the digital currencies, a topic on which state laws are typically silent. In April, the task force presented a model consumer guidance to help states provide consumers with information about digital currencies. A number of states, including California, Massachusetts, and Texas, have issued warnings to consumers that virtual currencies are not subject to traditional regulation or monetary policy. Basically saying that these aren't, you know, officially backed, but it's included insurance, bonding, and other security measures, and that values can fluctuate dramatically. Article focused on the high population big economy states of New York, California, and Texas, with a touch of Kansas, but other states are sure to follow. And whether you live in the U.S. or not, are there government regulations that you think would actually make sense for digital currencies? I've saw had someone tell me that on Overstock.com, you can actually go ahead and buy a TV on using Bitcoin. So that's pretty interesting.
Oh, I mean, we talked last week about Dell selling their computers using Bitcoin. So, I mean, you know, we know that Bitcoin is going to become a... Kurt's trying to adjust his mic over here, and he's cracking me up. I'm sorry. Bitcoin is going to become a more
popular.
There we go. You messed me up.
We're
about to start the show over again.
U.S. states edge toward crypto coin regulation.
But Bitcoin is going to become more popular, and there's going to be something else come out like this too. You know, it's just the way things are going to work. And yes, I do believe the U.S. is going to have to step in, and other countries, EU, other countries are going to have to step in and start to regulate this, just because it's going to affect things like taxes. It's going to affect things, you know, that are more in depth than just the currency itself. So, yeah, I think it's going to happen, and I'm glad to see that Bitcoin's still around. I wouldn't invest in it right now.
No,
it's too volatile. But you know, it's interesting to see what it's doing.
Some guy on Reddit said he lost $20,000 that he'd invested in it. He'd still spent like his life savings, and his wife said, "This is terrible. I'm going to leave you." And he's like, "I'm going to take out a loan and invest some more in it." So I mean,
sharp guy,
very sharp.
All Things D article about Lyft, which is a online taxi service, or an app-driven car service, as they call it, began its operations in New York City on Friday using professionally licensed drivers as called for by the taxi industry regulations. For now, the two-year-old service based in San Francisco is shelving plans to roll out quote-unquote ride-sharing, which would have linked car owners with passengers paying quote-unquote suggested donations instead of fares. Lyft said that it introduced its first professionally licensed model starting at 7 p.m. Friday, with the service available in all five boroughs in New York City. The service initially will involve a few hundred city licensed drivers and city license based in Brooklyn before expanding. Lyft also announced that it would suspend its ride sharing services in Buffalo and Rochester starting August 1st. So if you haven't heard about this, obviously, you know, here in Williamsburg, Kentucky, we don't have ride sharing Lyft services. But in bigger cities where you have lots of more cars and it's harder to get to work, this is just a different transportation service, like a bus or a taxi or a subway. And essentially, there's an app on the phone called an app called Lyft, and you communicate with other drivers, and you can get a ride using the app. You know, say I'm here, I need a ride, and then what they were talking about ride sharing is, you know, I I subscribe or, you know, hook up with Lyft service, and I say, okay, I drive my car from this location to this location every day, and I'll make myself available to let someone or someones ride in my car. And then other people could see that. It's kind of like a social networking for – Yeah, it's a social network for carpooling.
That's interesting idea. There could be safety concerns there, but
that's what happened here in New York. There was definitely safety concerns, and they said, no, you can't do ride sharing, but you can be a taxi service essentially, but you have to go through all the regulations.
Well, it makes sense. You can't just jump in and say, we got a business.
Yeah.
I saw this. I thought it was pretty interesting. If anybody realized how Microsoft, I don't know how many months back, purchased Nokia. And most people are thinking, why would they do that? And Forbes has an update on what sort of future Nokia faces as Microsoft reveals a strategy for making sense of the acquisition. Microsoft EVP of Devices, Stephen, I'm going to say Elop.
Sounds right to me.
Elop laid out a framework for cost cuts in a memo to employees on July 17th. Devices would focus on high and low cost Windows smartphones, suggesting a phasing out of feature phones and Android smartphones. Two business units, smart devices and mobile phones, would become one. Interesting. Thereby cutting overlap and overhead. Microsoft would reduce engineering in Beijing and San Diego and unwind engineering in Oulu, Finland. I don't know. It would exit manufacturing in Komorom, Hungary, and shift to lower cost areas like, why did I pick this? Manaus, Brazil, and Reynosa, Mexico.
You're doing a good job, Kurt. This is good.
Thank you. And reduce manufacturing in Beijing and Dongguan, China. Also, CEO Satya Nadella gave hints about how Microsoft will make money on Nokia during Tuesday's conference call. Devices, he said, go beyond hardware and are about productivity. Quote, I can take my Office Lens app, use the camera on the phone, take a picture of anything, and have it automatically OCR recognized and into OneNote in a searchable fashion. There's a lot we can do with smartphones by broadly thinking about productivity, end quote. In other words, the sale of a smartphone is a means to other sales. Now, that's pretty cool. I've already noticed on OneNote, if you upload a picture of that has text on it, you can already do OCR search on it. I mean, I haven't really looked to see how good it is, but I was able to look at, I think it took a picture of something and had a receipt like in the edge of the picture, and it found the words on the receipt, and I was able to search on it. So, I mean, that was in OneDrive, not OneNote.
So, you know, OCR or optical character recognition is important because you can scan a document that has words on it. And when you scan a document, it most time, if you have a normal scanner, it's just going to show up as a picture.
Right.
And you can't search, you know, if the document has the word Kurt in there 40 times, you can't search for Kurt. You just see an image. Mm-hmm. But like you said, with OCR, you can search for that. And that is important. I mean, that leads to productivity.
It's very cool stuff. That's one thing I've actually been asked a lot. I said, can I scan this, you know, I don't know, PDF document and have it come out as Word? And I'll say, as a picture. Oh, well, that's not what I wanted. Sorry.
Right. And if you have an OCR-capable scanner, you can. But, you know, if you don't, you can't. So, yeah, interesting stuff, especially for that to be on a cell phone. And speaking of cell phones, Network World article about cell phone unlocking, a bill that allows consumers to unlock their cell phones for use on other carriers passed its last hurdle in Congress on Friday, opening the way for it to become law once it's signed by President Obama. Senate Bill 517 overturns a January 2013 decision by the Library of Congress that ruled the unlocking of phones by consumers fell afoul of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or the DMCA. It had previously been permitted under an exception to the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA, which are generally aimed at cracking the digital rights management technology. Now, cell phones and smartphones are typically supplied to consumers with a software lock that restricts their use to a single wireless carrier. Removing that lock, or the process of unlocking the phone, means it can be used on networks of competing carriers. In the U.S., this is most often done with handsets that work on the AT&T or T-Mobile networks, which share common technology, but is also popular with consumers who want to take their cell phones overseas or use foreign networks rather than roaming services. So this is actually a really important bill, Bill 517 from Friday. And a few years ago, last year in January 2013, the decision was that unlocking phones was illegal. And that was a big hubbub. I mean, that caused a lot of outrage. And so now this bill overturns that and says, okay, it's not illegal. You can unlock a cell phone. If you go out to AT&T and you buy your cell phone outright, then you can unlock that cell phone and use it with a different carrier. Essentially, it's your phone. You bought it. You can unlock it and use it with a different provider if you want to. What's your thoughts, Kurt? Do you like this? I mean, it's not a deep dive article, right. But I mean, you know, it's something to discuss.
I think it's honestly a really good thing. I mean, you know, you pay all this money for this big fancy phone, and you're not getting the good service. You want to move it over. I mean, it's your phone. Of course, you buy it with a contract. You know, you pay your way out of the contract. It should be your phone. So I'm all for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it puts some pressure on the carriers. You know, if they want to keep you now,
better incentives.
Yeah, I mean, they you know, they need to be able to say, here's what we're going to do to make your service better. If you walk in, you say, I don't get service here, so I'm switching. Before, they could say, well, you know, have fun going to the other place and buying a new phone because you can't use the phone you got now with the other carrier. But that's not going to be a sticking point anymore.
Right.
So interesting to see, maybe how that'll change the minds of of the cell phone carriers a little bit.
Yeah, bingo. Yeah, that's one big thing, you know, us versus the man, or in this case, the company. More on cell phones. Do Apple and Google sabotage older phones? I guess you'd call this more smartphone news. Harvard economics professor, man, why am I getting all these weird names? Sindhil Mulanathan, works for me, takes a look at the New York Times at an interesting correlation between the release dates of new phone OSs and search queries that include frustration with the speed of the phones that people already have. This guy illustrates with graphs and gives plausible explanations for the difference, just how different the curves are over time for the search terms iPhone slow and Samsung Galaxy slow. It's easy to see with the iPhone graph, especially how it would seem like users that Apple has intentionally slowed down older phones to nudge them towards upgrading. While he's careful not to rule out intentional slowing of older phone models, that is possible after all, he cites several factors that mean there's no need to believe in a phone slowing conspiracy, and at least two big reasons, reputation and liability for companies such as Apple and Google, and cell phone manufacturers like Samsung, to not take part in doing this. He points out various wrinkles in what the data could really indicate, such as including genuine but innocent slowdowns caused by optimization for newer hardware. It's interesting to look at the difference between having mere statistics, not just people, you know, just rigorously gathered and knowing quite what they mean. So basically, you ever heard of the phrase planned obsolescence? This is kind of what they're pushing, what might be happening. You know, I've been through, seen on iPhone 3G, or the 3 original one, whatever. You know, you'd get a newer version of OS, it seems to get slower and slower and slower, and, you know, it's almost unusable. And, you know, this is where, you know, is this being done on purpose? Is that to nudge people into getting to a newer phone, moving off of the older hardware?
Sure,
you know,
it is.
It's definitely possible.
Yeah, sure it is. I mean, why not? You know, I can't run Windows 8 on my Commodore 64. This to me, I don't understand why this guy took the time to do this, but this to me seems like a no-brainer. You know, if I have the iPhone 5S and the iPhone 3GS, which is several versions apart, am I going to run iOS on... iOS 8 7 or the new 8 on the 5S faster than I do on the 3GS? Well, yeah.
Quite obvious.
I mean, it's quite obvious. I mean, why would you not optimize your software
for newer hardware that can handle it?
Exactly. And, you know, and provide new features. Now, you know, sometimes Windows is bad. Microsoft is bad for this. Bloating their OS with useless code that in the kernel that, you know, could be much more efficient and takes more processing on, and just because newer machines have it.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like back in the 90s and early 2000s when the memory war was on and memory was increasing. And, you know, programmers forgot the ideology that, okay, I need to make my program efficient. And, okay, now I've got megs and megs and megs and now gigs and gigs and gigs of memory, and I don't need to be efficient
anymore.
It's not
a factor anymore.
Right. Exactly. So it's not a factor anymore. Now, is that sloppy? Yeah, that's sloppy. But can we blame a company for, you know, bringing out software that matches the newer, better hardware? I don't think so. I think it's kind of a no-brainer.
Oh, right.
Interesting article.
Very interesting. I mean, so we'll see.
PC Mag article, Apple has confirmed earlier reports that it's acquired BookLamp, BookLamp, just in case I didn't pronounce that very well, presumably in an effort to bolster the company's ebook sales by tapping into the technology of the startup's Book Genome Project. The latter, which is now shut down, was often described as a kind of Pandora for books. BookLamp's skills at breaking books into data points, examining the quote-unquote DNA of various scenes that its system has created out of books it analyzes, allows it to construct a recipe of sorts for major themes. The CEO of BookLamp, Aaron Stanton, said the following here in a quote: "Say you're looking for a novel that's like The Da Vinci Code. We found that it contains 18.6% religion and religious institutions, 9.4% police and murder investigation, 8.2% art and art galleries, and 6.7% social societies and communities and other elements. We'll pull a book with similar elements, provided it is in our database." So, kind of cool what they're doing. Essentially, they're providing a way to search a different way to search for books. They go in and they use algorithms to say, okay, this book talks about this, 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 and this, and this other book is like this. And this is essentially just a way that you get people to buy different kind of books. So, you know, Apple will be able to use this in their ebook sales, obviously.
That's very cool.
I think so.
Data mining is a really, really cool thing. Kind of scary sometimes how well it can work.
Yeah, it's the same concept as when you go to Amazon.com and you click on that beanbag chair that you want to buy, and it says other people purchased the coffee holder for the beanbag chair, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. If there's any
extra beans,
extra beans for the beanbag chair, coffee beans to go in your beanbag chair. Sorry, I'm done.
I love seeing how the technology works in education. And according to this article, Chromebooks are outselling iPads in schools. Of course, last week we talked about a school out in California that purchased an iPad for the entire district, one for the entire thing, 20,000, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
So this one guy on Slashdot writes that Apple thrilled investors earlier this week when they revealed that they had sold 13 million iPads to schools and claimed 85% of the educational tablet market. But that wasn't the whole story. It turns out that Apple had only sold 5 million iPads to schools since February 2013, or an average of less than a million tablets a quarter over six quarters. It turns out instead of buying iPads, schools are buying Chromebooks. Google reported that 1 million Chromebooks were sold to schools last quarter, well over half of the 1.8 million units sold in the second quarter. With Android tablets getting better, Apple is losing market share in the consumer tablet market, and now it looks Apple is also losing the educational market to Google. Analysts are predicting that 5 million Chromebooks will be sold by the end of the year. How many of those will be sold to schools, do you think? I thought this was very interesting because I've looked into a lot of Google apps for business and also for schools and education. And there's a lot of, like, some people are moving absolutely everything over to it. I mean, you've got Google Drive or Docs or, you know, those services with basically Office replacements. And then you've also got email. And apparently they can control a whole lot of the data that goes over, you know, like maybe protected searches, not allowing certain content to go over. And apparently that can be very well controlled by their, you know, respective IT departments. But, you know, I think find it really interesting that they're going towards Chromebooks.
That is interesting. The numbers are interesting to me. You know, a million Chromebooks, which are over half of the 1.8 million units sold in the second quarter. So, you know, that to me is interesting. Over 50% of their sales in the second quarter were sales to schools.
I'm honestly surprised. I mean, I was very surprised by that. I mean, I don't know how many different types of Chromebooks there are, but they're cheaper than iPads, right? At least the largest, the
majority of them, I would think, are, yeah. You know, Chromebooks have some issues. I mean, depending upon which software your school uses, I mean, you can't run, like, Java or something like that on a Chromebook. But for the
most part, you
can't either, yeah. So, I mean, unless there's an app written for what you're trying to do, that's really, when you get down to the nitty-gritty of things, when it comes to tablet providers, phone providers, it all comes down to the App Store. No pun intended with that being Apple's name for it, but the place where you buy applications and the place where you have applications for that device. If there's more for company X than there is for company Y that associate to a particular market, then company X is going to win out in that market. Just because there's more applications or better applications for it.
Right.
You know, I mean, without applications, I don't care if you have an iPad or a Chromebook or a Surface or whatever, you got a paperweight, you know, without applications. So that's really where it's at. In a PC Mag article, Verizon story here, it says here the 22% or so of you Verizon subscribers still clinging to the company's unlimited data plan. And facing Verizon's continued attempts to switch you over to a more profitable plan for the company are about to get a stick instead of a carrot. According to the new report from Droid Life, Verizon's network optimization policy is being expanded to include 4G LTE service for its unlimited data customers. The concept of network optimization isn't anything new, obviously. Verizon actually introduced it way back in September 2011, but it only affected those using absurd amounts of data within the company's 3G network. The expansion of the optimization plan to 4G LTE will carry the same provisions as before. Those in the top 5% of Verizon's unlimited data users, which requires one to pull about an average of 4.7 gigabytes a month or so, who are enrolled in on an unlimited data plan and have fulfilled their minimum contract terms, which are now on a month-to-month plan, will be subject to network throttling if they try to connect up to a cell tower that is experiencing high demand. So it's not just, okay, we're going to throttle you. You have to be in that top 5% of users, which is, you know, around 5 gigs a month. And then you have to be enrolled in a limited data plan, and you will have already fulfilled your minimum contract terms. And then also you'll have to be on a tower that's experiencing high demand. So
all those have to be met.
All those criteria supposedly have to be met. And there are a lot of hoops to jump through, even though, which gives more weight to the fact that Verizon's throttling, while annoying, it won't affect a considerable majority of those holding on to their unlimited data plans. So in my thoughts on this, I would think it would be, at first you would think it would be big cities, but big cities have lots of cell phone towers. So you're probably looking at medium size cities who have a lot of people, and the cell phone towers just haven't caught up to those people yet. Kind of like a Richmond or even a Lexington or a Knoxville, places where there's a lot of people and maybe not the greatest cell phone coverage, even though those places have okay coverage, but maybe not enough towers to handle the amount of people.
Major load, yeah.
And then that may be where people start to see that kind of thing, I would think.
That makes sense. Let's see here. So Apple recently purchased, was it Beats? Mm-hmm. I believe it was.
Yep. Yep.
No idea why. Well, I've actually got a theory on that one. But Bose sues Apple, new Apple acquisition Beats, over patent violations. Bose has taken issue with some of the technology embodied in products in Apple's newly acquired Beats line of headphones. As Ars Technica reports, Bose is suing Apple, claiming that the Beats products violate 5 Bose patents covering noise cancellation and signal processing. Although Bose never mentions Apple in the 22-page complaint, the acquisition price of the private company may have played a part in spurring them to sue. The suit doesn't include a specific damage demand that they have filed a complaint with the U.S. Internal Trade Commission against Beats over the same infringement claims. That means the patent lawsuit filed in federal court will be stayed while the ITC case gets resolved first. I really didn't see that coming at all. I mean, I guess I just thought Bose did their own thing.
That makes sense for Bose. I mean, Beats got bought out by Big Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And what does Big Apple do? I mean, they don't have time to fool with these people who bring lawsuits against them. So, you know, typically they can win them. But isn't it easier just to give them some money and walk away?
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, I would say that's probably what Bose is looking for here. I'd say Bose is looking for some money to walk away with. I mean, I haven't looked at the numbers on Bose lately, but I think Bose is still doing okay. But Bose is starting to – it's a specialty market.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're not rolling. They're not rolling in the dough.
Yeah.
So they could probably use some extra cash.
Now, here's my personal theory. This is kind of going a little off topic of why Apple purchased Beats. Mm-hmm. And I read an article that supports some of this that said that future iPhones are going to remove the headphone jack. Have you seen that?
Mm-mm.
They're going to completely remove the headphone jack. It's where you have to have proprietary headphones that work wirelessly. And they're going to use Beats technology that has this. And now, obviously, the first couple iterations may have, you know, there's going to be some sort of workaround, something or other there. And there may even be a connector for the Lightning connector to go to headphone jack for an adapter. But I think Apple's really going to push wireless headphones. Either they probably use some sort of Bluetooth technology, whatever. But I think that's the direction that they're actually heading.
Well, as long as they include one in the box with my iPhone, then I'll be okay with that. If they don't, then that's kind of, I don't like that. And I'd say they probably won't.
Ooh, that's interesting. That's really interesting.
I mean, that's the thing. That's the cool thing about buying an iPhone. And it goes back to the days of having an iPod. You buy that iPhone, and what do you got there in the case?
Headphones.
You got a charger, you got all your cables, but then you also have headphones.
Yeah, exactly.
And just like the ones I'm wearing right now for the show.
I'm running
this show through the MacBook, and I'm actually listening to getting the monitor through my headset, through my Apple headphones. So, you know, I hope those continue to come in.
I do too, because those would be really cool.
Yeah.
That'd be really cool.
But. Exactly. I thought Kurt would like this. He loves China. So a BGR article about Microsoft in China. Microsoft is far from beating Sony in new gaming console war. Kurt will like this for two reasons.
It's about Xbox.
It's about gaming and it's about China.
Yay!
This is Kurt's favorite story. But the company is reportedly ready to attack a huge market in coming months. The Wall Street Journal has learned that Xbox One maker will partner with China Telecom, the country's most important fixed-line operator, to launch its latest console. Starting in September, China Telecom will become the exclusive Xbox One retailer in the country. The company revealed that potential buyers looking to enjoy games and entertainment experience at home will have to sign up for a broadband subscription when buying the new console. Neither China Telecom nor Microsoft mentioned the price of the Xbox One for China or an actual release date. The console is available in two versions, one without Kinect, which is $400, and one with Kinect, which is $500 in the U.S. and other markets.
Sure.
The move into China will give Microsoft access to up to 104 million potential buyers. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Which is certainly good news for a market where the Xbox and other video game consoles were banned for more than 10 years. The ban was lifted last September, and console makers, including Microsoft, surely want to officially cash in on that decision. So
that's interesting.
I mean,
that's very interesting.
And the question, this is just off the top of my head, but would this be good for gamers as well? Because won't this increase, I don't know how it works internationally, but won't this increase the number of players, like in multiple, what do you call those massive online games?
MMORPGs.
Okay,
massively multiplayer online role-playing games.
And I mean, would you classify Halo as one of those?
No, an FPS or an action game, first-person shooter.
Okay, but these people, if they played Halo, they would get into the same network that you play on?
Yes, and that's one thing that was revolutionary about Xbox Live back when the original Xbox released. It was typically online gaming was through PC, because PC was the only way you could really do it. I mean, Dreamcast pioneered it, but you would connect to servers, and or you'd be on you know, this server, this box, whatever, and say, yeah, hit me up, I'm on this one or whatever, and you'd all connect to this one server. Some servers were faster, some were slower, some were self-hosted, some were, you know, was hosted by the actual official, I guess whoever the company is, Games, I think it's GameSpy, GameSpot, had a had a bunch of servers that they took over, and there would be, you know, you'd release a game on PC, and then this second third party group would be the ones that you would connect through and sign up for an account for. So what was revolutionary about Microsoft and releasing Xbox Live is it really made it, streamlined it so easy for people to just, you get on and you connect. You don't have to worry about what servers you're connecting to. Your connection is already all is determined all automatically. Hosts are determined on each individual console. So if, say, you're in a group of four people, one of them is getting a bad connection, they're the host, it'll automatically either drop them or re-host to another Xbox with a faster connection. So it's that was revolutionary. So, yeah, you would be all together with all the same people.
It looks like to me that would be a plus for game players. I mean, you get more people in the game. I think that would be better, especially for that type of those types of games.
Oh, definitely. Especially games where sometimes there's a communication barrier, which is kind of fun. But yeah, you know, if it's some kind of game, you just, you know, point, click, you're done, you know, kill, whatever.
So yeah, not much communication barrier there.
No.
All right. Well, that wraps up our tech roundup. And now we're going to talk about App of the Week. App of the Week this week is Waze. www.waze.com. And Kurt, have you used Waze?
I have not.
Okay.
Tell me about it.
Waze is all about contributing to the common good out there on the road. This is a quote from their site. By connecting drivers to one another, we help people create local driving communities that work together to improve the quality of everyone's daily driving. That might mean helping them avoid the frustration of sitting in traffic, cluing them into a police trap, or shaving 5 minutes off their regular commute by showing them new routes they've never even knew about. So Waze is an app that you install on your mobile device, Android, or I think it's on Windows Phone too, and
of course
it's on iPhone. And you can, you don't have to sign up for an account, but you can sign up for an account. And people who are Wazers, they go in and they say, okay, you know, let's assume that you're driving up the interstate and 20 miles up ahead of you, there's a big storm. Well, then you'll see on Waze, there'll be a whole bunch of stuff pop up and everybody's putting rain. They'll notify. It's got little buttons there that you can just, you know, touch a button and say, okay, it's raining, it's snowing, it's doing whatever. And so you'll know I'm getting ready to hit rain. I may be a little later because traffic may slow down. And then if there's a wreck or an accident, I guess is a better way of putting it. If there's an accident, it'll also tell you, you know, here's an accident. Hmm. If there's police on the scene, it'll show you where police are. And if there's police down the road doing a stop or a check for, you know, speed or traffic stops, you know, it'll put that on there too.
Speed trap, yeah.
Exactly.
Hmm. Is that legal?
It is. I mean, you know, it's just it's like me calling you on the cell phone and saying, "Hey, there's police up here."
That's,
you know,
true.
You might want to slow down a little bit.
You know, First Amendment.
So it's a social network. I was on a vacation a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks ago. Went to the beach with my family and also some friends of ours. And my friend was in the car and he had Waze fired up on his phone. And he said, you know, it actually popped up and alerted him. Said, slow traffic ahead. And he started looking. He said, oh, okay, so there's an accident up ahead so many miles. And,
wow.
And people were taking pictures of it, putting it up on Waze. You could see what the accident was. The people up front said, okay, I've been here for how many ever minutes. Okay, traffic's starting to move now. It was actually pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
Now, Waze is a recent Google acquisition. I think we may have talked about this maybe in one of our first shows. I don't remember if we did or not. But Waze is a recent Google acquisition, which is good for them. And there's a section here on their site that says, how's it work? After typing in the destination address, users just drive with the app open on their phone to passively contribute traffic and other road data. But they can also take a more active role by sharing road reports on accidents, police traps, and any other hazards along the way, helping to give other users in the area a heads up about what's coming. In addition, local communities of drivers using the app, Waze also is home to an active community of online map editors who ensure that the data in their areas is up to date as possible.
Hmm.
So supposedly Waze is supposed to have really good maps too, which is another reason that Google acquired them, is to make their app, their maps better.
That's pretty cool.
Looks like Apple would have acquired them after that guy drove into the water in Australia that time. drove in the middle of a park. Got stuck out there. Yeah, anyway, but it's supposed to help make their maps better, too. But, Kurt, you going to go download this?
I don't know, and here's why. Have you heard about YouTube, the YouTube app on Windows Phone? Basically, Google is not really cooperating with anything of Windows Phone. But they'll do it for Apple phones. But that's, this is the whole of the story. So I wouldn't be surprised if either support drops for Windows Phone, or if they go in a different direction. But I have a Windows Phone, and I...
Right now, it's out there for Windows Phone Store, so
I might give it a try.
Yeah, I mean, it's out there for Google Play App Store and Windows Phone Store. So waze.com is where you can learn more about it, and you can just type in waze into your App Store on your mobile device and check it out. If you're a Waze user out there and you're listening to us right now, maybe you're on the road and you've got Waze fired up, shoot us a tweet there at WCCR Tech Talk, and let us know what you think about Waze while you're using it out on the road, and we'd enjoy some feedback. And again, Waze hasn't paid us for this, but we just thought we'd talk about
If you are on the road, please tweet safely.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's right. You're not supposed to tweet while you're on the road, are you? Forgot about
that. You know, this whole thing sounds a little scary. You know, all these people on their phones, like, oh, wait, I've got to tell everyone about this wreck up ahead. And then they contribute to the wreck.
Exactly. So don't do that, but be safe about it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that is App of the Day, Waze.com. Go check it out. Next, we're going to transition into our deep dive. All right, starting out our deep dive today is a Network World article about mobile malware. The majority of Android devices currently in use contain a vulnerability that allows malware to completely hijack installed apps and their data, or even the entire device. The core problem is that Android fails to validate public key infrastructure certificate chains for app digital signatures, said Jeff Forrestal, Chief Technology Officer of Blue Box Security in San Fran. According to Google's documentation, Android applications must be signed in order to be installed on the OS, but the digital certificate used to sign them does not need to be issued by a digital certificate authority. It's perfectly allowable and typical for Android applications to use self-signed certificates, is what the documentation for those says. However, Android contains hard-coded certificates from several developers that can give apps created by those developers special access and privileges inside the OS. One such certificate belongs to Adobe and gives apps signed by it or certificates issued by it the power to inject code into other installed apps. Now, Forrestal believes that this behavior exists to allow other apps to use Adobe's Flash Player plugin. The certificate chain validation vulnerability, which Blue Box has dubbed Fake ID, was reported to Google in April, and a patch was made available to device manufacturers. After receiving word of the vulnerability, we quickly issued a patch that was distributed to Android partners as well as to AOSP, Google representative said Tuesday via email. Google Play and Verify apps have also been enhanced to protect users from this issue. At this time, we have scanned all applications submitted to Google Play, as well as those Google has reviewed from outside of Google Play, and we have seen no evidence of attempted exploitation of this vulnerability. Motorola has released updates with the patch for some devices, and more vendors will probably do the same over the upcoming weeks. However, due to the fragmentation of the Android ecosystem, which means it's so varied across the board, the availability and delivery of these is going to be vary from manufacturers and carriers. Blue Box has a site out there. They have actually have a free application that you can run on your Android phone. It's in the Google Play Store, so just do a Google Play search for Blue Box, BLUEBOX, and you can check to see if your device has any vulnerabilities to this fake ID attack. So long article there just to say that Android's starting to get some vulnerabilities. We're starting to see some vulnerabilities come to mobile devices. You know, what do we as users need to be careful of about using our mobile devices and being worried about malware attacks?
I personally would say look out for anything that says asking for, you know, don't give everything permission to, you know, access your location. Don't give everything permission to access your contacts. Not saying that malware is going to flat out ask you, hey, can I hack your phone? But just be wary of, you know, don't just say yes, yes, yes to every single thing you install. That'd be one thing I personally would try. I've not personally used Android except to help someone with a problem on their phone, but that'd be one thing I'd be mindful of, and I guess on any phone, really, because, you know, you install something, say, such and such would like access to your location, access to your contacts, whatever. So that's what I'd think. That's what I think I'd look for first off, and try not to just install everything willy-nilly.
You're exactly right. I mean, anytime you're installing anything, whether it be a mobile device or on your PC, you don't just say yes, 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 and go ahead. You got to actually read what it's saying, because sometimes it's going to install stuff that you don't want installed.
Ask toolbar.
Exactly.
Java. Notoriously, Java installer comes with an ask toolbar, and usually it's one checkbox. Now I see three checkboxes to include an updater and something else that will include the ask toolbar. And the reason those are included are because it helps pay for to keep the whatever application it is free or less expensive, typically, or, you know, whatever kind of advertising, I guess. But
still looks like malware to me, though.
It does look like malware, and,
the scary part's this, okay? Why do people write malware and spyware and viruses for devices? Why are there more viruses and malware and spyware out there for Windows machines than there are for Linux machines? Because there's more of them, right?
Yep.
So there's more Windows machines than there are Linux machines out there.
I'm going to go fishing. I'm going to fish where there are fish, where the most fish are.
So when we talk about the device market, what is the largest growing device market right now?
Android.
Not only Android, but mobile.
Oh, mobile. Gotcha. Yeah, mobile.
You're right, though. I mean, Android is growing huge, and that's one of the reasons that... And, okay, this wasn't somebody writing a crack for this, okay? This was a vulnerability, but that's where cracks start.
That's true.
There's a, you know, every time that somebody cracks something in Windows, it's because there's a vulnerability out there that allows them to do it. So, you know, it's interesting to see that they're starting to hit and look at mobile devices.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how many people do you walk by on the street now who don't have an iPhone or an Android device?
I mean, you're almost guaranteed they're going to have one of those two devices.
Right. I mean, or a Windows mobile phone. So, I mean...
Thanks for including that.
Yeah, I'll include you in there. Maybe they have a Windows mobile phone, too.
Yay!
So, you know, it makes sense that people who are trying to steal information...
It's an untapped market.
Would start to look at this, exactly. So, to me, this is scary.
It's going to be really lucrative for a while, because people are who would have thought 10 years ago viruses on my phone? No, no one's going to think that, and you know it's going to be a new paradigm.
Well, 10 years ago, what's it going to do? Is it going to keep me from playing Snake on my Nokia phone? You know, I mean, there was really nothing on my phone that was
worth hacking.
Exactly.
Right.
But now, banking. You know, people have banking, password keepers. You know, just imagine if somebody could have used this vulnerability, which came from a certificate infrastructure issue. Certificates is what allows the application to talk back with a server or with an outside host or with an application within itself. It's kind of like saying, okay, here is a key. Use this key to get in. And there was that quote here that said, it's perfectly allowable and typical for Android applications to use self-signed certificates. So that's like me saying, okay, I've made my own paper key for you to use to get into my house, and my lock really isn't that good, so here you go. You know, and anybody can do this. Anybody can go make a lock for my door. That's what that's actually saying. So, I mean, it's scary to me that all this contact data, email, banking, like you said, can get hacked into.
Yeah, pretty much anything that's on your phone, you know, consider it a target.
You're exactly right. And, I mean, just because we're talking about Android today doesn't mean we won't be talking about iOS next week.
Well, I mean, I wish I had the article in front of me, but this was a couple of years ago. This was back when RIM was still big. I mean, there was researchers that found a vulnerability where they would send a malformed text message to one to a RIM device, BlackBerry, sent one to an iPhone, and at the time, Windows Phone. This was before the Windows Phone 7, so it was very different from what it looked like now. And with that malformed text message, the phone didn't know how to handle it, and it gave access to other sections of the phone, such as making calls, controlling the operating system itself, and basically cracked it wide open. And, you know, instantly, like within hours, Windows responded and RIM responded, but Apple did not. So, but, you know, later they did, like, I think a week later. But, you know, it's very possible. And this was at least 2 years ago.
Well, and, you know, it's important for these companies to respond to these type of incidents in a quick manner. You're exactly right. So, you know, if you have a mobile device, don't flush it down the toilet or anything, but, you know, be aware that any device you have, you know, it can be cracked, and, you know, you need to be careful with the type of information that you're storing on there, because, you know, it can be accessible.
It's very interesting what you talked about, I think it was last week, with, you know, how are we going to connect in the future? You know, we're going to have our phones or whatever device it is that's always connected, and everything might connect through that. If that's going to be the main target for malware, I mean, you know, we'll have to rethink how everything works, to be honest, you know.
And I mean, there's big antivirus companies out there like Bitdefender and Symantec and Kaspersky and others like that who already have things out there for mobile phones, antivirus protection for mobile phones. But, you know, a lot of people use it because they don't see the reason to. And we're going to have to start seeing the reason to, because it's going to change. So, interesting article, interesting deep dive to see how that's going to turn out. Another deep dive, kind of along the same lines, Recode.net article, cracking of the Internet of Things. Hewlett-Packard said that its Fortify application security unit conducted an analysis of the 10 most popular consumer Internet things on the market and found 250 security vulnerabilities in the products, an average of 25 faults apiece. HP doesn't identify each product, but it does describe them in broad brushstrokes. They were from manufacturers of TVs, webcams, home thermostats, remote power outlets, sprinkler controllers, hubs for controlling multiple devices, door locks, home alarms, scales, and garage door openers. As a basic rule, these devices often run stripped-down versions of Linux and have the same basic security concerns that you might concern that might be in place on a server or a computer running Linux. But the problem is the people building these things don't take an effort to secure them the way that you would a traditional computer. So what's happening is that these manufacturers are rushing to get their products to market without doing harder work locking down their devices against the most basic kinds of attacks. So this magnifies the potential problem that the device might be compromised, and then overlapping vulnerabilities can lead to another attack one upon another. And so, you know, this is really interesting. I mean, we've talked to some on the show about the Internet of Things, which is essentially, you know, connecting things around you like your refrigerator, your TV, your oven,
watch,
door lock, whatever, to the Internet to control them. But anytime you connect anything to the Internet, you're vulnerable.
And the Internet's connecting to you.
Yeah.
That's the way to put it.
So, I mean, what happens if somebody gets control of your door locks on your house?
Ooh, that's scary stuff. I mean, obviously, lock it. Ransomware. I mean, that's first thing I think of. I mean, not just say locking you out, but, you know, they come in and get in whatever they want to, or they say give us $500, whatever, and we'll unlock it. Of course, they don't. I mean, ransomware is a big thing now. Well, not that big, but it's definitely growing. Oh, that's insane. I mean, what other things? I guess the biggest thing is, you know, A, there's Internet of Things versus privacy. Well, those Internet of Things versus almost safety, to be honest.
Well, you know, the article, even though to me it seemed a little off topic for this article, but the article talked about how in the beginning of the Target issue, that, you know, where they lost all that credit card information, in the beginning of the Target issue, the way that they found out that people accessed the Target systems was through a outside third-party company from an HVAC dealer, HVAC air conditioning dealer, being able to enter the system with outside credentials that they were given. Now, I mean, that doesn't really have to do with the Internet of Things, I don't guess. I mean, being able to control an AC unit kind of is Internet of Things, but it just makes you think the more and more things that you place on the Internet, like a door lock or an air conditioner or a, you know, a TV or whatever, that just gives people more access to get inside your home or to get inside your business. So,
I mean, there's amazing amount of ease of use. I get the right word here. Convenience, you know, to be able to say, get on your phone and check a security system, look through the cameras on your at your house to see how things are going. But that means it could also be turned against you and people can watch you. I mean, have you heard of the issue where some, I guess they call them a hacker, got into a baby monitor and started, you know, they saw the name printed on the wall and started trying to taunt the babe that was sleeping in there? I mean,
and they were way, way away. I mean, they were nowhere close to that because it was connected to the internet.
Right. That's scary stuff. Luckily, the child happened to be deaf, but I mean, that's scary. Well, what else can they get into? And now baby monitors have, I already mentioned, you know, they had a video on it, but I mean, that's crazy.
Well, I mean, these companies didn't do a better job of securing these devices down. And as a consumer...
And educating them on how to secure it.
Right. And as a consumer, we need to be careful not just to leave everything as default settings. I mean, okay, in the article here, it says 8 devices failed to require passwords stronger than 1, 2, 3, 4, either on the device itself or on a corresponding website. First of all, they should require a stronger password. Second of all, as users, as consumers, as me and you and everybody listening to this podcast and everybody listening to this radio show right now, we need to use stronger passwords than 1, 2, 3, 4 or password or Billy Bob.
We've been over this before, yeah.
You know, so I mean, is it the company's fault? Sure. Is it the consumer's fault? Sure. Don't just install something in your house and leave the default settings. If you leave the default settings, that means I can walk up beside your house and go out to, try to jump on your network, find out what kind of router you have, go out to the website for the router and read the book, and all the default settings are there. You haven't changed any of them. And I have complete access of your home network at that point. So, you know, it's important for our listeners to understand that anytime you buy a network-connected device, you know, make those settings changes. Don't just leave them default, and don't make them easy, because somebody may try to interrupt that and cause problems. That'd be horrible for somebody to just be able to get in your house by accessing your door lock code and be able to just walk in and do whatever they wanted to do. And you thought your house was more secure because you had a fancy lock. So, interesting article, and I hope that that all of us, including me and you, will understand the importance of making our devices more secure by locking them down and following the instruction manuals provided by the manufacturer to make it more secure.
I'd give you a corollary on why the device manufacturers might not want to encourage you to change those settings, because let's say you have to change the password. People just use that as another step that they don't want to have to go through, and says, ease of setup, this wasn't easy to set up. I mean, so I can understand where they're coming from. I'm not, say, encouraging that, but it's still not, it's not worth it, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, they need to understand that security is more important than, you know, having a password of 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's the end of our deep dive today. We're coming up towards the end of the show, and as usual, we're going to talk a little bit about tech in numbers. Today was not too great of a day for the market. Technology dropped by a decent percentage. Our winner today for gaining in the technology field was Medidata Solutions. They are a global provider of software as a service for clinical technologies. They were up today almost 6 points with a 15% change for a total price of $45.08. And our loser for today is Alliance Fiber Optic Products. They design, manufacture, and market a range of fiber optic components and integrated modules. They were down almost 4 points for a 20% change with a final price of $13.17 today. And that is tech in numbers.
And now moving on to my probably my favorite segment. Let's see here. Weird and wacky tech. And today we have the USB warmer slippers and gloves. This is wired or wireless, but let's see. The distributor is RareMonoShop.com. Price is $29, $29.50 plus shipping. USB warmer gloves. Let's see, $22.50. Okay. What it is, fuzzy slippers and mittens with removable finger covers that feature built-in USB-powered warmers for those frosty winter work days. You can even modify the temperature while they're in use. Why you want it? Because you'll never finish up those TPS reports with icy fingers and frozen toes. And what's really great, and I always struggle to find a really good goofy tech because it's got to be kind of useful, but, you know, not too far out there. But this website is RareMonoShop.com. It actually took me to RareMonoShop.jp, so it's Japanese, as we learned from our episode about DNS.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a treasure trove of good tech there. So we're going to, that's definitely one we're going to have to revisit. Like, there was an air conditioner for your shoe that's USB powered as well. So I assume you're sitting at your desk, your foot's hot, and you stick this thing in your tongue and it pulls the air in, I guess. So we'll see how that goes. But,
Tongue of your shoe, that is.
Yeah. thanks for clarifying that. I'm glad. Someone got that.
So go out and buy your USB warmer slippers and gloves before it gets winter, so you can plug them into your computer and stay warm all winter. And if you're cold natured like some people are, maybe you just have it all summer, all year long, and keep it plugged in and make sure that everything stays warm.
Hey, I'll be honest. Be careful if you have any kind of insulator powered that warms, you know, those cables can get bent and that can cause a fire, because, you know, that is a little, it can be a safety concern. But
I would say that anything from this site is a safety concern, especially since it's on weird and wacky tech. Please don't go out and buy that. We were it's really true, it's out there, but it's weird
and wacky.
Exactly. Well, that about finishes up our show for today, Tech Talk Today. We really appreciate you listening to us on WCCR 94.5 LPFM. Don't forget, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/WCCR Tech Talk and on Twitter at WCCR Tech Talk as well. You can catch our podcast. We'll have it up later tonight of the show by searching for Tech Talk Today on iTunes or just by visiting our Facebook page. And once again, I'm Justin Hensley.
And I'm Kurt Lawson. We're going to be signing off. And be sure to tune in next week with our Summer Tuesday lineup for this summer 2014. And coming on from 7 to 9, we have the Figure 4 Fallout with Russell Ridner, Bo Kidd, Casey Malone, Dustin Hardin, and Justin Durbin. And it should be a lot of fun. I've actually learned a little bit about pro wrestling from listening to this.
There you go.
Yeah. All right. Y'all take care.
Good night.